Chapter 18. By the time they got back to Balliol, two more of the detainees were down with the virus. Dunworthy sent Colin to bed and helped Finch get the detainees to bed and phone the infirmary. "All our ambulances are out," the registrar told him. "We'll send one as soon as possible." As soon as possible was midnight. He didn't get back and to bed till past one. Colin was asleep on the cot Finch had set up for him, the Age of Chivalry next to his head. Dunworthy debated pulling the book away, but he didn't want to risk waking him. He went into bed. Kivrin could not be in the plague. Badri had said there were 4 hours slippage, and the plague had not hit England until 1348. Kivrin had been sent to 1320. He turned over and closed his eyes determinedly. She could not be in the plague. Badri was delirious. He had said all sorts of things, talked about lids and breaking china as well as rats. None of it made any sense. It was the fever speaking. He had told Dunworthy to back up. He had given him imaginary notes. None of it meant anything. "It was the rat," Badri had said. The contempts hadn't known it was spread by fleas on the rat. They had had no idea what caused it. They had accused everyone, Jews and witches and the insane. They had murdered half-wits and hanged old women. They had burned strangers at the stake. He got out of bed and padded into the sitting room. He tiptoed around Colin's cot and slid the Age of Chivalry out from under Colin's head. Colin stirred but didn't wake. Dunworthy sat on the window seat and looked up the Black Death. It had started in China in 1333 and moved west on trading ships to Messina in Sicily and from there to Pisa. It had spread through Italy and France, 80,000 dead in Siena, 100,000 in Florence, 300,000 in Rome, before it crossed the Channel. It had reached England in 1348. A little before the feast of St. John the Baptist, the 24th of June. That meant a slippage of 28 years. Badri had been worried about too much slippage, but he had been talking of weeks, not years. He reached over the cot to the bookcase and took down Fitzwiller's Pandemics.
"What are you doing?"
Colin asked sleepily.
"Reading about the Black Death," he whispered. "Go back to sleep."
"They didn't call it that,"
Colin mumbled around his gobstopper. He rolled over, wrapping himself in his blanket.
"They called it the Blue Sickness."
Dunworthy took both books back to bed with him. Fitzwiller gave the date of the plague's arrival in England as St. Peter's Day, the 29th of June, 1348. It had reached Oxford in December, London in October of 1349, and then moved north and back across the Channel to the Low Countries and Norway. It had gone everywhere except Bohemia and Poland, which had a quarantine. And oddly, parts of Scotland. Where it had gone, it had swept through the countryside like the angel of death, devastating entire villages, leaving no one alive to administer the last rites or bury the putrefying bodies. In one monastery, all but one of the monks had died. A single survivor, John Clynne, had left a record. And lest things which should be remembered perish with time and vanish from the memory of those who are to come after us, he had written. I, seeing so many evils and the whole world, as it were, placed within the grasp of the evil one. Being myself as if among the dead, I, waiting for death, have put into writing all the things that I have witnessed. He had written it all down, a true historian, and then had apparently died himself, all alone. His writing on the manuscript trailed off, and below it, in another hand, someone had written, "Here it seems the author died." Someone knocked on the door. It was Finch in his bathrobe, looking bleary-eyed and distraught. "Another one of the detainees, sir," he said. Dunworthy put his finger to his lips and stepped outside the door with him.
"Have you telephoned infirmary?"
"Yes, sir. And they said it would be several hours before they can dispatch an ambulance. They said to isolate her and give her dimetadine and orange juice."
"Which I suppose we're nearly out of," Dunworthy said irritably.
"Yes, sir, but that's not the problem. She won't cooperate." Dunworthy made Finch wait outside the door while he dressed and found his face mask, and they went across to Salvin. A huddle of detainees was standing by the door, dressed in an odd assortment of underthings, coats and blankets. Only a few of them were wearing their face masks. "By the day after tomorrow, they'll all be down with it," Dunworthy thought.
"Thank goodness you're here," one of the detainees said fervently. "We can't do a thing with her."
Finch led him over to the detainee who was sitting upright in bed. She was an elderly woman with sparse white hair, and she had the same fever-bright eyes, the same frenetic alertness Badri had had that first night.
"Go away," she said,
when she saw Finch and made a slapping motion at him. She turned her burning eyes on Dunworthy.
"Daddy,"
she cried, and then stuck her lower lip out in a pout.
"I was very naughty,"
she said, in a childish voice.
"I ate all the birthday cake, and now I have a stomachache."
"Do you see what I mean, sir?" Finch put in.
"Are the Indians coming, Daddy?"
he asked.
"I don't like Indians. They have bows and arrows."
It took them until morning to get her onto a cot in one of the lecture rooms. Dunworthy eventually had to resort to saying,
"Your daddy wants his good girl to lie down now."
And just after they had her quieted down, the ambulance came.
"Daddy,"
she wailed when they shut the doors.
"Don't leave me here all alone."
"Oh dear," Finch said when the ambulance drove off.
"It's past breakfast time. I do hope they haven't eaten all the bacon."
He went off to ration supplies, and Dunworthy went back to his rooms to wait for Andrew's call. Colin was halfway down the staircase, eating a piece of toast and pulling on his jacket.
"The vicar wants me to help collect clothes for the detainees," he said, with his mouth full of toast.
"Great Aunt Mary telephone. You're to ring her back."
"But not Andrews?"
"No."
"Has the visual been restored?"
"Nope."
"Wear your regulation face mask," Dunworthy called after him, "and your muffler."
He rang up Mary and waited impatiently for nearly 5 minutes until she came to the telephone.
"James?"
Mary's voice said.
"It's Badri. He's asking for you."
"He's better then?"
"No. His fever's still very high, and he's become quite agitated. Keeps calling your name. Insists he has something to tell you. He's working himself into a very bad state. If you could come and speak with him, it might calm him down."
"Has he said anything about the plague?"
he asked.
"The plague?" she said, looking annoyed. "Don't tell me you've been infected by these ridiculous rumours that are flying about, James. That it's cholera, that it's breakbone fever, that it's a recurrence of the pandemic."
"No,"
Dunworthy said.
"It's Badri. Last night, he said, it killed half of Europe, and it was the rats."
He's delirious, James. It's the fever. It doesn't mean anything.
She's right, he told himself. The detainee ranted on about Indians with bows and arrows, and he didn't begin looking for Sioux warriors. She had conjured up too much birthday cake as an explanation for her being ill, and Badri had conjured up the plague. Didn't mean anything.
Nevertheless, he said he would be there immediately and went to find Finch. Andrews hadn't specified what time he would call, but Dunworthy couldn't risk leaving the phone unattended. He wished he'd made Collins stay while he spoke to Mary. Finch would very likely be in Hall, guarding the bacon with his life. He took the receiver off the hook so the phone would sound engaged, and went across the quad to the hall. Miss Taylor met him at the door. I was just coming to look for you, she said. I heard some of the detainees came down with the virus last night.
Yes,
he said, scanning the hall for Finch. Oh, dear.
So I suppose we've all been exposed.
He couldn't see Finch anywhere. How long is the incubation period? Miss Taylor asked.
12 to 48 hours,
he said. He craned his neck, trying to see over the heads of the detainees. That's awful, Miss Taylor said. What if one of us comes down with it in the middle of appeal? We're traditional, you know, not council. The rules are very explicit. He wondered why traditional, whatever that might be, had deemed it necessary to have rules concerning change ringers infected with influenza. Rule 3, Miss Taylor said. Every man must stick to his bell without interruption. It isn't as if we can put somebody else in halfway through if any of us suddenly keels over, and it would ruin the rhythm. He had a sudden image of one of the bell ringers in her white gloves collapsing and being kicked out of the way so as not to disrupt the rhythm. Aren't there any warning symptoms? Miss Taylor asked.
No, he said.
That paper the NHS sent around said disorientation, fever, and headache. But that isn't any good. The bells always give us headaches.
I can imagine, he thought,
looking for William Gadsden or one of the other undergraduates he could get to listen for the phone. If we were council, of course, it wouldn't matter. They let people substitute right and left. During appeal of Tidham Bob Maxims at York, they had 19 ringers. 19! I don't see how they can even call it appeal. None of his undergraduates appeared to be in Hall. Finch had no doubt barricaded himself in the buttery, and Colin was long gone.
Are you still in need of a practice room?
He asked Miss Taylor. Yes. Unless one of us comes down with this thing. Of course, we could do Stedman's, but that would hardly be the same thing, would it?
I'll let you use my sitting room if you will answer the telephone and take down any messages for me. I am expecting an important long-distance call, so it's essential that someone be in the room at all times.
He led her back to his rooms. Oh, it's not very big, is it? She said. I'm not sure there's room to work on our raising. Can we move the furniture around?
You may do anything you like, so long as you answer the telephone and take down any messages. I'm expecting a call from Mr. Andrews. Tell him he doesn't need clearance to enter the quarantine area. Tell him to go straight to Brasenose and I'll meet him there.
Well, all right, I guess, she said, as if she were doing him a favor. At least it's better than that drafty cafeteria. He left her rearranging furniture, not at all convinced that it was a good idea to entrust her with this, and hurried off to see Badri. He had something to tell him. It killed them all, half of Europe.
The rain has subsided to little more than a fine mist, and the anti-EC picketers were gathered in force in front of the infirmary. They had been joined by a number of boys Colin's age, wearing black face plasters and shouting, "Let my people go." One of them grabbed Dunworthy's arm.
"The government's got no right to keep you here against your will," he said, thrusting his striped face up to Dunworthy's face mask.
"Don't be a fool," Dunworthy said. "Do you want to start another pandemic?"
The boy let go of his arm, looking confused, and Dunworthy escaped inside. Casualties was full of patients on stretcher trolleys, and there was one standing next to the elevator. An imposing-looking nurse in voluminous SPGs was standing next to it, reading something to the patient from a polythene-wrapped book.
"Whoever perished, being innocent," she said,
and he realized with dismay that it wasn't a nurse. It was Mrs. Gadsden.
"Or where were the righteous cut off?" she recited.
She stopped and thumbed through the thin pages of the Bible, looking for another cheering passage, and he ducked down the side corridor and into a stairwell, eternally grateful to the NHS for issuing face masks.
"The Lord shall smite thee with a consumption," she intoned, her voice resounding through the corridor as he fled, "and with a fever, and with an inflammation."
"And he shall smite thee with Mrs. Gadsden," he thought, "and she shall read you scriptures to keep your morale up."
He went up the stairs to isolation, which had now apparently taken over most of the first floor.
"Here you are," the nurse said.
It was the pretty blonde student nurse again. He wondered if he should warn her about Mrs. Gadsden.
"I'd nearly given you up," she said. "He's been calling for you all morning."
She handed him a set of SPGs, and he put them on and followed her in.
"He was frantic for you half an hour ago," she whispered. "Kept insisting he had something to tell you. He's a bit better now."
He looked, in fact, considerably better. He had lost the dark, frightening flush, and though he was still a bit pale under his brown skin, he looked almost like his old self. He was sitting against several pillows, his knees up and his hands lying lightly on them, the fingers curved. His eyes were closed.
"Badri," the nurse said, putting her imperm gloved hand on his shoulder and bending close to him. "Mr. Dunworthy's here."
He opened his eyes.
"Mr. Dunworthy?"
"Yes," she nodded, across the bed, indicating him. "I told you he'd come."
Badri sat up straighter against the pillows, but he didn't look at Dunworthy. He looked intently ahead.
"I'm here, Badri," Dunworthy said, moving forward so he was in his line of vision. "What was it you wanted to tell me?"
Badri continued to look straight ahead, and his hands began moving restlessly on his knees. Dunworthy glanced at the nurse.
"He's been doing that," she said. "I think he's typing."
She looked at the screens and went out. He was typing. His wrists rested on his knees, and his fingers tapped the blanket in a complex sequence. His eyes stared at something in front of him. A screen? And after a moment he frowned.
"That can't be right,"
he said, and began typing rapidly.
"What is it, Badri?"
Dunworthy said.
"What's wrong?"
"There must be an error,"
Badri said. He leaned slightly sideways and said,
"Give me a line by line on the TAA."
He was speaking into the console's ear, Dunworthy realized.
"He's reading the fix," he thought. "What can't be right, Badri?"
"The slippage,"
Badri said, his eyes fixed on the imaginary screen. "Readout check,"
he said into the ear.
That can't be right.
What's wrong with the slippage?
Dunworthy asked.
Was there more slippage than you expected?
Padre didn't answer. He typed for a moment, paused, watching the screen, and began typing frantically.
How much slippage was there? Padre,
Dunworthy said. He typed for a full minute and then stopped and looked up at Dunworthy.
So worried,
he said thoughtfully.
Worried over what, Padre? Dunworthy said.
Padre suddenly flung the blanket back and grabbed for the bed rails.
I have to find Mr. Dunworthy, he said.
He yanked at his cannula, pulling at the tape. The screens behind him went wild, spiking crazily and beeping. Somewhere outside, an alarm went off.
You mustn't do that, Dunworthy said,
reaching across the bed to stop him.
He's at the pub,
Padre said, ripping at the tape. The screens went abruptly flatline.
Disconnect,
a computer voice said.
Disconnect.
The nurse banged in.
Oh, dear. That's twice he's done that, she said. Mr. Choudhury, you mustn't do that. You'll pull your cannula out.
Go and get Mr. Dunworthy. Now, he said. There's something wrong.
But he lay back and let her cover him up.
Why doesn't he come?
Dunworthy waited while the nurse retaped the cannula and reset the screens, watching Badri.
He looked worn out and apathetic, almost bored.
A new bruise was already forming above the cannula. The nurse left with,
I think I'd best call down for a sedative.
As soon as she was gone, Dunworthy said,
Badri, it's Mr. Dunworthy. You wanted to tell me something. Look at me, Badri. What is it? What's wrong?
Badri looked at him, but without interest.
Was there too much slippage, Badri? Is Kivrin in the plague?
I don't have time,
Badri said.
I was out there Saturday and Sunday.
He began typing again, his fingers moving ceaselessly on the blanket.
That can't be right.
The nurse came back with a drip bottle.
Oh, good, he said.
And his expression relaxed and softened, as if a great weight had been lifted.
I don't know what happened. I had such a terrific headache.
He closed his eyes before she had even hooked the drip to the cannula and began to snore softly. The nurse led him out.
If he wakes and calls for you again, where can you be reached?
She asked. He gave her the number.
What exactly did he say?
He asked, dripping off his gown.
Before I arrived.
He kept calling your name and saying he had to find you, that he had to tell you something important.
Did he say anything about rats?
He said.
No. Once he said he had to find Karen or Catherine.
Kivrin?
She nodded. Yes. He said, I must find Kivrin. Is the laboratory open?
And then he said something about a lamb. But nothing about rats, I don't think.
A good deal of the time I can't make it out.
He threw the imperm gloves into the bag.
I want you to write down everything he says. Not the unintelligible parts,
he added before she could object.
But everything else. I'll be back this afternoon.
I'll try, she said. It's mostly nonsense.
He went downstairs. It was mostly nonsense. Feverish ramblings that meant nothing. But he went outside to get a taxi. He wanted to get back to Balliol quickly, to speak to Andrews, to get him up here to read the fix. That can't be right, Badri had said, And it had to be the slippage. Could he have somehow misread the figure, thought it was only 4 hours, and then discovered what? That it was 4 years? Or 28?
You'll get there faster walking, someone said. It was the boy with the black face plasters. If you're waiting for a taxi, you'll stand there forever. They've all been commandeered by the bloody government.
He gestured toward one just pulling up to the door of casualties. It had an NHS placard in the side window. Dunworthy thanked the boy and started back to Balliol. It was raining again, and he walked rapidly, hoping that Andrews had already telephoned, that he was already on his way. Go and get Mr. Dunworthy immediately, Vadrea said. Now, there's something wrong. And he was obviously reliving his actions after he had got the fix, when he had run through the rain to the Lamb and Cross to fetch him. That can't be right, he had said. He half ran across the quad and up to his rooms. He was worried Miss Taylor wouldn't have been able to hear the telephone's bell over her bell ringers clanging. But when he opened the door, he found them standing in a circle in the middle of his sitting room in their face masks, their arms raised and hands folded as if in supplication, bringing their hands down in front of them and bending their knees one after the other in solemn silence. Mr. Bazingame's scout called, Miss Taylor said, rising and stooping. He said he thought Mr. Bazingame was somewhere in the Highlands. And Mr. Andrews said you were to call him back. He just called. Dunworthy put the trunk call through, feeling immensely relieved. While he waited for Andrews to answer, he watched the curious dance and tried to determine the pattern. Miss Taylor seemed to bob on a semi-regular basis, but the others did their odd curtsies in no order he could detect. The largest one, Miss Piantini, was counting to herself, frowning in concentration.
I've obtained clearance for you to enter the quarantine area. When are you coming up?
He said as soon as the tech answered.
That's the thing, sir, Andrew said.
There was a visual, but it was too fuzzy to read his expression.
I don't think I'd better. I've been watching all about the quarantine on the vids, sir. They say this Indian flu is extremely dangerous.
You needn't come in contact with any of the cases, Dunworthy said. I can arrange for you to go straight to Brazenose's laboratory. You'll be perfectly safe. This is extremely important.
Yes, sir, but the vidders say it might have been caused by the university's heating system.
The heating system? Dunworthy said.
The university has no heating system, and the individual ones of the colleges are over 100 years old and incapable of heating, let alone infecting.
The bell ringers turned as one to look at him, but they did not break rhythm.
It has absolutely nothing to do with the heating system, or India, or the wrath of God. It began in South Carolina. The vaccine is already on the way. It's perfectly safe.
Andrews looked stubborn.
Nevertheless, sir, I don't think it would be wise for me to come.
The bell ringers abruptly stopped.
Sorry,
Miss Piantini said, and they started again.
This fix must be read. We have an historian in 1320, and we don't know how much slippage there's been. I'll see to it that you're paid for hazardous duty, Dunworthy said,
and then realized that was exactly the wrong approach.
I can arrange for you to be isolated or wear SPGs or...
I could read the fix from here, Andrews said. I've a friend who'll set up the access connections. She's a student at Shrewsbury.
He paused.
It's the best I can do. Sorry.
Sorry, Miss Piantini said again.
No, no. You ring in second place, Miss Taylor said.
You dodge 2-3 up and down and 3-4 down and then lead a whole pull. And keep your eyes on the other ringers, not on the floor. 1-2 and off. They started their minuet again. I simply can't take the risk, Andrew said. It was clear he couldn't be persuaded. What is the name of your friend at Shrewsbury? Dunworthy asked. Polly Wilson, Andrew said, sounding relieved. He gave Dunworthy her number. Tell her you need a remote read. 1A Inquiry and Bridge Transmit. I'll stay by this number. He moved to ring off. Wait, Dunworthy said. The bell ringers glanced disapprovingly at him. What would the maximal slippage be on a drop to 1320? I've no idea, Andrew said promptly. Slippage is difficult to predict. There are so many factors. An estimate, Dunworthy said. Could it be 28 years? 28 years? Andrew said, and the amazed tone sent a gust of relief through Dunworthy. Oh, I wouldn't think so. There's a general tendency toward greater slippage the farther back you go. But the increase isn't exponential. The parameter checks will tell you. Medieval didn't do any. They sent an historian back without parameter checks? Andrew sounded shocked. Without parameter checks, without unmans, without recon tests, Dunworthy said. Which is why it's essential I get this fix read. I want you to do something for me. Andrew stiffened. You don't have to come here to do it, he said rapidly. Jesus has an on-site set up in London. I want you to go over there and run parameter checks on a drop to noon, 13th of December, 1320. What are the locational coordinates? I don't know. I'll get them when I go to Brazenose. I want you to telephone me here as soon as you've determined maximal slippage. Will you do that? Yes, he said, but he was looking doubtful again. Good. I'll telephone Polly Wilson. Remote read, 1A Inquiry, Bridge Transmit. I'll ring you back as soon as she's got it set up at Brazenose, Dunworthy said, and rang off before Andrews could renege. He held on to the receiver, watching the bell ringers. The order changed each time, but Miss Piantini apparently did not lose count again. He telephoned Polly Wilson and gave her the specifications Andrews had dictated, wondering if she had been watching the vidders too and would be afraid of Brazenose's heating system. But she said promptly, I'll need to find a gateway. I'll meet you there in 3/4 of an hour. He left the bell ringer still bobbing and went over to Brazenose. The rain had slowed again, and there were more people on the streets, though many of the shops were closed. Whoever was in charge of the Carfax Carillon had either come down with the flu or forgotten about it because of the quarantine. It was still playing Bring a Torch, Jeanette Isabella, or possibly O Tannenbaum. There were 3 picketers outside an Indian grocer's, and a half dozen more outside Brazenose, with a large banner they were holding between them that read, Time travel is a health threat. He recognized the young woman on the end as one of the medics from the ambulance. Heating systems and EC and time travel. During the pandemic, it had been the American Germ Warfare Program and air conditioning. Back in the Middle Ages, they had blamed Satan and the appearance of comets for their epidemics. Doubtless, when the fact that the virus had originated in South Carolina was revealed, the Confederacy or Southern Fried Chicken would be blamed. He went in the gate to the porter's desk. The Christmas tree was sitting on one end of it, The angel perched atop it.
I have a student from Shrewsbury meeting me to set up some communications equipment, he told the porter. We'll need to be let into the laboratory.
The laboratory is restricted, sir, the porter said.
Restricted?
Yes, sir. It's been locked, and no one's allowed in.
Why? What's happened?
It's because of the epidemic, sir.
The epidemic?
Yes, sir. Perhaps you'd better speak with Mr. Gilchrist, sir.
Perhaps I had. Tell him I'm here and I need to be let into the laboratory.
I'm afraid he's not here just now.
Where is he?
At the infirmary, I believe. He... Dunworthy didn't wait to hear the rest. Halfway to the infirmary, it occurred to him that Polly Wilson would be left waiting with no idea where he'd gone. And as he came up to the hospital, it came to him that Gilchrist might be there because he'd come down with the virus. Good, he thought. It's what he deserves. But Gilchrist was in the little waiting room, hale and hearty, wearing an NHS face mask, rolling up his sleeve in preparation for the inoculation a nurse was holding.
Your porter told me the laboratory is restricted, he said, stepping between them. I need to get into it. I found a tech to do a remote fix. We need to set up transmission equipment.
I'm afraid that's impossible, Gilchrist said. The laboratory is under quarantine until the source of the virus is determined.
The source of the virus? He said incredulously. The virus originated in South Carolina.
We will not be certain of that until we've obtained positive identification. Until then, I felt it was best to minimize all possible risks to the university by restricting access to the laboratory. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm here to receive my immune system enhancement.
He started past Dunworthy toward the nurse. Dunworthy put out his arm to stop him.
What risks?
There has been considerable public concern that the virus was transmitted through the net.
Public concern? Do you mean those three half-wits with the banner outside your gate?
He shouted. This is a hospital, Mr. Dunworthy, the nurse said. Please keep your voice down.
He ignored her.
There has been considerable public concern, as you call it, that the virus was caused by liberal immigration laws, he said. Do you intend to secede from the EC as well?
Gilchrist's chin went up, and the pinched lines appeared by his nose, visible even through the mask.
As acting head of the history faculty, it is my responsibility to act in the university's interest. Our position in the community, as I'm certain you're aware, depends on maintaining the goodwill of the townspeople. I felt it important to calm the public's fears by closing the laboratory until the sequencing arrives. If it indicates that the virus is from South Carolina, then of course the laboratory will be reopened immediately.
And in the meantime, what about Kivrin?
If you cannot keep your voice down, the nurse said, I shall be forced to report you to Dr. Ahrens.
Excellent. Go and fetch her, Dunworthy told her. I want her to tell Mr. Gilchrist how ridiculous he's being. This virus can't possibly have come through the net.
The nurse stamped out.
If your protesters are too ignorant to understand the laws of physics, Dunworthy said, surely they can understand the simple fact that this was a drop. The net was only open to 1320, not from it. Nothing came through from the past.
If that is the case, then Miss Engel is not in any danger, and it will do no harm to wait for the sequencing.
Not in any danger? You don't even know where she is.
Your tech obtained the fix and indicated the drop was successful and that there was minimal slippage, Gilchrist said.
He rolled down his sleeve and carefully buttoned the cuff. I'm satisfied Miss Engel is where she's supposed to be.
Well, I'm not. And I won't be until I know Kivrin made it through safely.
I see. I must remind you again that Miss Engel is my responsibility, not yours, Mr. Dunworthy. He donned his coat. I must do as I think best.
And you think it best to set up a quarantine around the laboratory to placate a handful of crackpots?
He said bitterly.
There is also considerable public concern that the virus is a judgment from God. What do you intend to do to maintain the goodwill of those townspeople? Resume burning martyrs at the stake?
I resent that remark. And I resent your constant interference in matters which do not concern you. You have been determined from the first to undermine medieval, to keep it from gaining access to time travel, and now you are determined to undermine my authority. May I remind you that I am acting head of history in Mr. Basingham's absence, and as such...
What you are is an ignorant, self-important fool who should never have been trusted with medieval, let alone Kivrin's safety.
I see no reason to continue this discussion, Gilchrist said. The laboratory is under quarantine. It will remain so until we obtain the sequencing. He walked out. Dunworthy started after him, and nearly collided with Mary. She was wearing SPGs and reading a chart.
And you will not believe what Gilchrist's done now, he said. A group of picketers convinced him the virus came through the net and he's barricaded the laboratory.
She didn't say anything, or even look up from the chart.
Badri said this morning that the slippage figures can't be right. He said over and over. There's something wrong.
She looked up at him distractedly, and back at the chart.
I have a tech, ready to read Kivrin's fix remotely. But Gilchrist locked the doors, he said. You must talk to him. Tell him the virus has been firmly established as originating in South Carolina.
It hasn't.
What do you mean, it hasn't? Did the sequencing arrive?
She shook her head. The WIC located their tech, but she's still running it. But her preliminary read indicates it's not the South Carolina virus. She looked up at him. And I know it's not. She looked back at the chart. The South Carolina virus had a zero mortality rate.
What do you mean? Something happened to Badri?
No, she said, shutting the chart and holding it to her chest. Beverly Breen. He must have looked blank. He had thought she was going to say Latimer. The woman with the lavender umbrella, she said, and sounded angry. She died just now.
This ends side 2 of cassette 9 of Doomsday Book. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette 10.